Coming up on Windows Weekly, I, Micah Sargent, join Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell, and we kick off the show talking about the AI reorg at Microsoft. That's right, there's a new Microsoft AI organization within the company that reports directly to Satya Nadella. Then a very short section on what's new in Windows. By way of Windows 10, what in the world? Then Microsoft 365, including some AI updates and some lack of AI updates, depending on what programs you are using. We also talk about Apple maybe partnering with Google on AI and where Microsoft plays into all of that. Upcoming Surface event from Microsoft. And of course, we've got Xbox Corner and the tips and picks of the week as well. All of that coming up on Windows Weekly. Stay tuned. This episode is brought to you by Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero trust AI.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, Richard Campbell, and this week, Micah Sargent, episode 873, recorded Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. Amino Man. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by Melissa, the data quality experts since 1985. Melissa offers free trials, sample codes, and flexible pricing, ROI guarantee, unlimited technical support to customers all around the world, and Melissa's international address validation cleans and corrects street addresses worldwide. Addresses automatically transliterate from one system to another, for example, Chinese to Cyrillic. You can download the free Melissa lookup app on Google Play or the App Store. No sign up is required. With it, you can validate an address and personal identity in the U.S. or Canada. You can check global phone numbers to find caller, carrier, and geographical information, and check global IP address information, plus more. Melissa has achieved the highest level of security status available by gaining FedRAMP authorization. While these technologies are exclusively for governmental agencies, all Melissa users automatically gain this superior level of security. Melissa's solutions and services are GDPR and CCPA compliant and meet SOC 2 and HIPAA high trust standards for information security management. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. It's time for Windows Weekly. I am Micah Sargent, subbing in for Leo Laporte, who is currently on vacation, getting a tan and whatnot. But I am here to join the two veteran Windows washers of the world. It is first Paul Thurrott. Joining us from Macungie. Is it Lower Macungie? Is it not? That's a conversation for not
we
now.
Don't have enough time for this conversation.
How you doing, Paul?
I am doing well, thank you. How are you?
I am doing well, thank you for asking. Also first, see how we did that? Joining us from Madeira Park, BC, Canada, it's Richard Campbell. Hello, Richard.
Hey, Micah. It's great to be home for a change because it won't be true next week.
You're always all over the place. It's an interesting life you lead.
And it's funny how the audience has gotten into this, you know, instead of getting guests from all over the world, we just send the hosts everywhere.
Yeah. One of these days, I'm going to have to get your tips on travel, because as much as you travel, I'm sure you've got plenty of how you make it happen where it's not a slog and a terrible time on planes and whatnot.
Maybe you just imagine that Richard is like a hedgehog and he just rolls up into a little ball and then the plane lands and unrolls himself.
I miss most flights. I fall asleep as we pull off the gate. I wake up as the tires touch the ground.
I actually thought about that for my next flight, making that happen.
Well, you're, see, Micah, you know, you're normally sized. So I think flying for you is not as hard as it would be for me, at least, and maybe for Richard. We got a dog 5 years ago. It was a really big animal, really gangly. And I could tell very quickly, like, this dog is never comfortable, right? You could just tell. She'd have to move around all the time. She could never be comfortable. And I was like, I get it. This is how I am on a plane. You know,
I am 6'3".
No normal sitting, you know. Can't do it. So
you're taller than you look, Mike.
Yeah, I'm 6'3", so my legs end up being
Legs just keep going. Yeah, so you have the problems.
That's okay. It's funny. It's a very common thing I get anytime I meet somebody in person. Wow, you're taller than I thought you were. And I thought, what does that say about my presentation? Sure. I just must be very small. Anyway, let's do this show. Let's talk about Windows, because there was kind of a big announcement Satya Nadella put forth, and it is time to do a shakeup, a reorganization at Microsoft. No one's throwing any CEOs to the curb or anything like that. It's not that level of shakeup, but certainly some restructuring. Well, I guess, then again, tell us about it.
I don't know what to think. I think there's more story here than we know so far, because when I look at this reorg, and I should just say at a high level, involves Microsoft creating what they called a new organization, which is kind of an interesting word, called Microsoft AI, that reports directly to Satya Nadella. It is led by former co-founders of an AI company called Inflection, and one of whom is the CEO of that business, or whatever we're going to call this organization. The other one of whom was the other co-founder and former chief scientist. These are not people from Microsoft.
No, I think this is an acquisition disguised as a reorg.
Yeah. So, right. Maybe a mini version of what could have happened with OpenAI, where Sam Altman had been deposed and everyone said, we're leaving. And Microsoft said, well, welcome to Microsoft. And and that might have happened.
Yeah.
That could be. I just find it interesting that it isn't more of a mix of Microsoft people and these new people.
Yeah, I think it will be. I just think this is early days that they've managed to basically recruit out the leadership of Inflection, who are also drivers behind DeepMind. Which I think OpenAI was the gutting of Google Brain. This feels like the gutting of DeepMind. And DeepMind, while we always think of it as the Go company, they're the guys who cracked Go, that's not the important thing they're working on. The important thing is AlphaFold. They've largely solved protein folding for the medical industry. And have open sourced it, by the way. And so it's like we're in the midst of a medical transformation from the ability of the software to do protein folding calculations that basically were impossible any other way. And to the point where we even have trouble validating what they've done.
Right. But I mean, okay. But I'm trying to understand how this works within Microsoft. You know, it's a very...
Yeah, I think it was just a lucky grab. You got two incredible rock stars that want to come on board. Yeah. Take them.
Okay, but obviously there is some set of employees and executives at Microsoft who were already leading the AI charge there. Mm-hmm. I just find this interesting. I'm curious how this kind of plays out. Plus, I feel like the description of who goes where is somewhat incomplete at this time. So, for example, most people probably know that Microsoft CTO Kevin Scott was, you know, personally responsible for bringing together OpenAI and Microsoft and starting that relationship. Mm-hmm. He's been rewarded for that by being named executive vice president of AI in addition to his job as, you know, just being CTO generally of Microsoft. And has been, and is still is, apparently, responsible for Microsoft's overall AI strategy. But that itself creates a very strange dynamic, because the person who is directly responsible for Microsoft's AI strategy is not in charge of their AI business. And the person who is does not report to him. He reports directly to Satya Nadella.
Scott.
I'm sorry. Well, no, I meant the guy from DeepMind. Yeah. I apologize. Suleiman, Mustafa Suleiman. Mm-hmm. So you've got this. It's interesting, right? Now, we already know about things like Copilot and where Copilot is in Bing and Edge and elsewhere in Microsoft 365 and Windows, et cetera. That team is moving into Microsoft AI and will report to that new person. There is a Gen AI team that was separate that will also move into that business and report to Mr. Suleiman. No word about Windows, nothing there. Although they mentioned that Rajesh Jha, who is responsible for the experiences and devices division or business or whatever we want to call that, which is oversees Microsoft 365 and Windows, he's continuing in his position and will partner closely with this new team on Copilot for Microsoft 365. No word on Windows. Although, you know, again, as we've said in the past, I should say, you know, Copilot on Windows is just another front end for Copilot that has some Windows specific stuff, but that's not particularly interesting. But I find it interesting that they did not mention Windows. And
yeah, I think you're hitting on the big part here, Paul, that this isn't about front ends. This is about back ends.
Yes.
And so OpenAI is a back end that Azure is wrapping. And now this could easily be a totally different back end. This could be, you know, derived from the DeepMind generative models.
Right.
And I look at the relationship they have with Mistral now as well as another back end option.
Well, I think, look, that kind of diversification is smart, right? I think a lot of people, you could be all in on this, be very excited for Microsoft's direction with AI, but you still should look at this OpenAI thing and say, wow, this is putting a lot of eggs in one basket, you know, the future of the company.
They seem to be getting more baskets now, and they're keeping them separate from each other, which I think is probably smart.
Right. Yeah. And I should note, too, they were very specific that we're continuing this open AI relationship, which Nadella described as the most strategic and important partnership that Microsoft has, right? I mean, duh, but it's always nice to have that spelled out. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to make of this. Even when Microsoft first announced what was then called Bing Chat about a year ago, February, I think it was February, January, whenever that was, there was some description, I think it was probably, it doesn't matter who said it, but there was some description that, you know, we have this OpenAI ChatGPT technology that's kind of the foundation, but we're, you know, Microsoft described like they were McDonald's, like they're adding some secret sauce on top of it. And that secret sauce included such things as Bing search results for the internet stuff. And then they wouldn't talk about the rest of it. Right. Okay. But I we can debate whether pure OpenAI ChatGPT or Microsoft's kind of flavor of it is better, whatever that means, et cetera, more accurate, whatever it is. I guess we could just have that discussion. But I've always been a little nervous about that relationship with OpenAI, and I wonder if this isn't the start, but a big step toward trying to diversify and make sure that nothing bad happens there.
And I think there's lots of reasons for them to do it. Yeah. Not the least of which is that they're being heavily scrutinized for their relationship with OpenAI.
Yes.
And so one of the ways you make it less threatening is say, we have a lot of relationships.
That's right.
But even if it did end up being restricted, they have alternatives.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so I mean, you know, we'll see. I feel like there's always this weird thing that can happen with not just Microsoft, any big company where one day there's a couple people on stage and then the next day things happen and the next event there's different people on stage, you know. So as soon as Build in May, we might see some of these people maybe for the first time at a Microsoft event representing Microsoft, right? And then 6 months from then, we'll see. We'll see if it's the same. I'm very curious about this. You know, they're not presenting it as a reorg. It's a reorg. Right. I mean, very much as a reorg. Especially when you consider that AI is the future of Microsoft, explicitly stated. And now we have a new Microsoft AI business. That's our organization, as they call it.
The opening line on the PR piece is he's joining to lead Copilot. And I would argue that's a great way to solve a very intractable problem, which is that a year ago he told all these different product teams go make a Copilot. Well, now they have, and it needs to be rationalized.
Yeah.
And bringing in effectively an external actor to do that rationalization is one way to defeat the political problem that is rationalizing.
Yeah, and it may be a way to trim back on some of the Copilot fat,
plenty of that is repetitive. Like, the good news about what he requested to do is everybody experimented, and you're going to find some great experiments, but you're also going to find a lot of derivative work. And so, yes. You know, nobody wants 200 Copilots, even if 200 exist. Really, arguably, we want one. And they keep making gestures like there's going to be one while continuing to announce more. So maybe Mustafa's the guy that can actually line all this up.
We're going to find out. There have been other acquisitions that have led to big executives coming in and not lasting a long time necessarily. Or
not
sometimes
wrong.
People get put.
I mean, I look at poor Miguel Diakaza and I have nothing, you know, Miguel's crying all the way to bank. He's fine. But one of the first missions once he joined Microsoft was to rationalize XAML. And that was almost an impossible task, which
I was going to say, did they succeed at that?
They did, but I don't think it was Miguel in the end, but I would argue the rationalization of XAML is Maui.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I you're probably right. It's just that, unfortunately, Maui is, in the words of a fish called Wanda, the smallest frickin' province of Microsoft. And, you know,
That wasn't going to change the fact that it wasn't going to be better fragmented. So they have got everybody working together.
That is true.
More or less. So it's not as big and important a play, but I mean, the other side of this is also very much a Gatesian playbook. Keep shuffling the cards. Do not let empires be built.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, sure. I mean, I 100% agree. Some of the Copilot creep needs to be reined in. You don't have to follow this industry at all to kind of already have a feeling of almost AI fatigue just this quickly. Right. And that maybe this stuff needs to be corralled a little bit and simplified, and we'll see. But I do feel like we were on a path to a new Copilot every week for 2024. And maybe that's too much.
It is too much. There's already too many.
Yeah, it is too much. Right.
And so whatever strategy you've got to take to find a way to make it easier for all of us to consume the thing we want to consume. I mean, what would be worse than to be typing into the wrong Copilot?
I don't know why I laugh. That's actually
hilarious.
But I think that's how the Terminator movies start that way.
Yeah, exactly it.
Yeah.
Meant the world. I meant my Minecraft world, not the whole world.
It's like when you send an email to the wrong people and they're like, you know, this is work, right, Bob? I don't know what those sexy pictures were all about, but maybe you didn't mean to send it out to the group. You could do some real damage. I mean, I can't help but think about the Windows end of this for me, and I guess there is no Windows end. I mean, we're still in that same holding pattern where the industry is trying to sell us on MPUs, but there is nothing that takes advantage of MPUs that anybody cares about.
Right.
In fact, there's almost nothing at all that takes advantage of it anyway. And we still haven't seen anything that, you know, changes that. I mean, there's been some rumors around blah, 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 whatever happening later this year. But all this does is make background blur in paint or photos slightly faster than it is now, that's not going to be good enough, right? Because actually that stuff works fine right now.
Yeah, the MPUs that work right now are in your phones. There's nothing happening in operating systems near as I can tell. Even on the Mac side, really.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I don't think that we've written about this on Throughout.com, but there was I don't know if it was Gurman or someone else had a rumor or a report from sources inside Apple, and we're going to talk about some Apple AI stuff later, actually, but about how this would impact like iOS in the future, right? It's probably something Micah knows a little bit about, like here's the list of how we're going to use generative AI in the product. And there's nothing surprising. Like, it all makes sense. It's all very logical. It's the type of thing we see elsewhere. If you can look at what maybe Google is doing on the Pixels or Samsung's doing on the latest phones. Be like, yeah, no, I mean, this makes sense.
Yeah, parody.
But then you look at Windows and you're like, so what are we doing? Like, no, what's the point?
I still think Windows runs alongside every other product at Microsoft now, which is people still struggle with. It's not the flagship product anymore. Azure is.
Right.
And so the Windows team has to get their own act.
Well, even on the client, it's not the flagship product, right? It's kind of, it's Microsoft 365. I mean, I think by virtue of the fact that this thing runs everywhere, not just desktop, but also mobile and the web. And actually we'll touch on this later too, but it's a way to reach more customers with Copilot than is possible with Windows, right? Even if most of them are Windows users. The fact that you can get these capabilities in the web, mobile, Mac, whatever it might be, that's just a bigger audience.
I want to drive the digression, but here, let me drive the digression.
Okay.
Vroom, vroom.
If I had the firepower inside of the Windows team, this is where you build the ecosystem for all LLM interfaces. Right. This is your opportunity to reach out to all the product stacks to say Windows will be your gateway. Here's how you hook up to it so that all these products can work together. And then you can easily port that to the Mac and other platforms. But first you build an ecosystem, which shockingly is something Microsoft's actually good at.
Yep.
I just don't know that when I think about the firepower team for ecosystems inside of Microsoft right now, it's M365.
Yep. Oh, totally. Yeah. And by the way, I mean, new app development at Microsoft 365, such as it is web-based, right? We're not talking about big new Microsoft, or Windows apps, right? Native Windows apps.
No, you're talking about back-end. Yeah, the innovations in the back-end, the front-end is Power Platform and other web-derived heterogeneous client solutions.
Yep. Yeah. So, I don't know. That's too bad. Anyway, I'd like to see an org chart. I'd like to see Microsoft be more transparent about who, what, where, and now. I mean, we used to have this. You could look up senior leadership team at Microsoft.com and you get these black and white photos of the team and who they were and what they did and, you know, and all that stuff. And that day is just over. You know, we don't really get that level of understanding. And I know part of it is probably just because it changes so much.
Mm. I would also say, I don't name me a tech giant that does that anymore.
Yeah. I think it's only, the information, the website, you have to pay for it. They are like the only folks out there I see.
They who actually
are
keep track of this
keeping track of this kind of stuff and have quite literally just that set up.
I think this is tied to, there have been no changes in the way that the SEC or whatever requires these companies to report earnings or whatever it might be, but all of them collectively have delivered less and less information over the years with no repercussions whatsoever.
Since the SEC has essentially allowed these companies to obfuscate their income structures, they've no longer had declared members.
That's right. Yeah. So I think this might be tied to that. And even this, I pointed this out when I first said this, you know, a Microsoft AI organization, what does that mean? You know, Microsoft has three primary business units, right?
And a set of wholly owned
under one of those? Is it a fourth business unit? Yeah. Does it have because there is no direct financial accounting of any kind? Does it just sort of exist on the outside? You can make a case that, I bet Bill Gates would have made this case that you don't have an AI division. Everything's AI.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and I think you're exactly right. I bet you this ends up being a wholly owned subsidiary, which up until now has been acquisitions they didn't want to wreck.
Interesting.
Right. LinkedIn, GitHub, and Bethesda, those are all being run as wholly owned subsidiaries. I wonder if this is the first time they're going to make one. You know why they would do this? One of the reasons?
Well, some antitrust issues.
I think that's part of it. Yeah. But also now you have an excuse for everybody who wants to work on AI instead of Microsoft, go apply to the other group.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, they do the same dynamic in the dev side between the dev div of Microsoft and GitHub, and folks float between them to some degree.
Yeah.
I wonder if this is like a chance to, everybody's working on it. Now we need to calm things down. If you really care that much about AI, go apply to the wholly owned arc.
Okay. I mean, there are big and small versions of this throughout the history of Microsoft. Vermeer was handled this way a million years ago when they bought the company that makes FrontPage. A guy from Microsoft, Chris, I can't think of his name, but left a position on the Office team to become essentially the CEO of Vermeer. Mm-hmm. Which was owned by Microsoft, and like you said, GitHub, Mojang, Activision Blizzard. Over, well, not really. ZeniMax, I guess. ZeniMax.
Yeah, the gaming. The gaming's a little bit different. Yeah. Where, you know, certainly what happened with GitHub with Nat Friedman coming in, and then now Thomas Demke. Like you are seeing Microsoft people move there, and all up and down the org. You know.
Yeah, but that should be the point, right? That they go in and out. And that's fine. But this is, I would say, is by far the biggest because, like I said, Microsoft has made the explicit case. This is the future of the company. And then they've kind of backed that up by AI-ing everything, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I think they're creating an innovation center to deal with certain things.
Okay.
I'm excited.
Almost like an AI Microsoft research kind of a thing.
I wonder. And the DeepMind thing is what hit me the hardest. Just because what they're working on, I would argue, is one of the very first examples of a machine learning model exceeding human capability in a massive way. Our ability to manipulate proteins with traditional software has been minor. We've barely been able to do it. And what DeepMind pulled off in 2022 at the CISP was profoundly important.
Okay. It sounds like Paul might disagree. I actually agree with
Richard on that. No, I just don't. To me, this is another planet. Like, I don't know that this is not a Microsoft world to me. But
yeah, and this has got nothing to do with ChatGPT and LLM and so forth. This is a different caliber of generative AI.
Right.
I care about it because too much of these technologies are steeped in science fiction. You know, Arthur C. Clarke didn't write about folding proteins, right? There's no MCU for folding proteins. And yet this is astonishingly important. And machine learning models.
I am sure one of those superheroes is based on folding proteins. That's got to be a thing.
Yeah.
What can you do?
I
can
Amino Man.
I see.
Amino Man. Oh, dear. That's great. Amino Man.
Okay. Anyhow,
anything so else for AI reorg before we take a break?
No, that's the big one. I feel like I've been saying this a lot lately, but you know, the Microsoft security breach, for example, I just feel like there's more to the story, and I think Richard, it sounds like he completely agrees, and maybe even knows more about it, or has deeper suspicions than I guess. But I think this is, but I wanted to just highlight that because I think, I don't think we've heard the last of this. I think this becomes more, you know, I think this becomes more, I guess, if that makes sense.
Or it unravels. It could go either way. Like Joe Cherosh, when he came into the AI group at Microsoft, and a lovely man and brilliant. But I think he slammed against the monolith that is Microsoft and couldn't move things the way he wanted to and eventually moved on. And it might go that way. And I hope it doesn't.
It could also be what do you call it? Quantum computing, right? Mm-hmm. 3, 5, 10, whatever years ago, there was Microsoft made a huge breakthrough in quantum computing. It was the focus of Ignite, I think it was, or Build, whatever that conference was.
They did a piece on it,
But they opened the show with it, right? Remember, that was the one that we got to do, the NASA thing that fell apart and whatever. But
that was also when everybody was having a run on quantum computing, but they've had a new set of walls.
No, it was definitely, there's definitely some, there's some competitive stuff there. But the feeling was, okay, we're going to start hearing about quantum computing every year. And I got to tell you, they've been pretty silent on that one, whatever year that was.
They smashed into hard bits.
Yeah.
But you hit on an interesting point. Maybe what they're doing here is next gen beyond what OpenAI has been able to do.
Interesting.
And so this is creating a place to allow innovation.
We're going
to
replace you. I guess we'll see. Yeah. I do. I feel like OpenAI Microsoft ends badly. And that's been kind of a background fear for me.
Because organizationally they're in conflict, right? Like.
Yeah, fundamentally, right. At fundamentally some point, we will outgrow our need for you. Yes.
Yeah. And I think, and Satya has already been caught unprepared once.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Around OpenAI. I don't think he's going to let it happen again. I suspect after that little incident where we saw, dark Satya for the first time, that he went with his, senior folks and said, how are we going to make sure this never happened again? Besides putting an observer on the board, which he did with OpenAI. But in general, and one of it would obviously is, let's make sure we're not dependent on
them. What was that observer's name again? Grima Wormtongue? Was that, is that the right person? I mean, Zing. I don't know.
You're not going to believe what they're saying about you, Satya.
Okay.
Well, let's ponder the grim worm tongue of it all. Coming up, we'll be talking about Windows. Surprise, surprise, here on Windows Weekly in just a moment. Breathe in, breathe out. And we are back. It is time to talk about what's going on with Windows specifically over at Microsoft. Of course, joined as always by Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell. I am subbing in for Leo Laporte, who will be back with you all next week. What's going on in the Windows world?
I am surprised to say there hasn't been much in the way of insider builds, although now I see see, this is the new thing.
They wait till the show starts, man.
Yeah, just as the show starts.
Beep, bastards.
Maybe so we'll get to move to Thursdays. Should we
move to Thursdays? So, I barely remember this, but the show started on Thursdays. I think we moved to Wednesdays about 217 years ago. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. We as a Windows community have a problem letting things go, right? So everyone knows that Windows 10 was never going to be updated. And my God, is that the new sticking point? Just like Windows 10 was going to be the last version of Windows. Remember that little chestnut? People just, man, they have a hard time with this stuff.
Let's call it aspirational.
It's
right up until the Mac.
I don't know.
Right.
I think making bold pronouncements is pretty much always a mistake, maybe is the issue here. But Windows 10 is getting new features, right? So happening.
That's my
favorite quote from a listener, reader, or I guess a viewer. Was at a Microsoft. I just finished. Barry, Joe, and I had done something post keynote. Got off the stage, talked to this group of people, and this guy out of the blue said, "But you said, that Google would never buy YouTube," and he kind of went on, but I stopped listening because I'm like, "Didn't Google buy YouTube like 20 years ago?" I'm like, "What are you talking about? I don't remember that." I had to go look it up, and I did. I guess I speculated at one point 22 years ago, whenever this was, that Google would never buy YouTube, and then they did. So I'm always wrong now.
Oh my gosh!
And I don't. You know, like people have that kind of memory, like about the weirdest little details. Like it's like you say something, it kind of just crawls in there in the brain or whatever. Tied to this, I have my own little insanity around the way that Microsoft updates Windows these days, right? Because it is both illogical, sporadic, and irrational, and unpredictable, and not transparent, and blah, 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 whatever. And what I mean by that is we have this insider program. I went on at length last week about this, I think. And they have different tiers, right? And you know, logically, you'd introduce a feature in Canary and then move it down to dev and then move it to beta. And then when it moved into release preview, you could say, you know what? I think this feature might make it into the next version of Windows. But we don't have next versions of Windows, and those things don't happen. And new features are introduced all over that scale. And sometimes new features are just introduced in stable and they've never been tested. And it's hard to know what's going on. So now we have a new wrinkle. That combines both the things I just discussed, the Windows 10 thing, the inability of people to let go, and my insanity over how they introduce new features in Windows, because there's a new feature coming to Windows 10 that they've never tested in Windows 11. And you know it's coming to Windows 11 because it's so obvious, but it's just weird how they do things now, right? So sometime in the past 2 months, whatever it was, if you boot into your Windows 11 computer, you might have noticed what looks like a live tile in the middle bottom of the screen for some reason. That is the weather. It's the weather. They probably call it a card now because we can't use the term tile anymore. You don't want to give people PTSD. And why it looks different than everything else on the screen is kind of unclear, but there it is. And so that just appeared. And now they're testing new sports, traffic, and finance cards on the lock screen as well, but in Windows 10, not in Windows
11. I love it. I still have Windows 10 machines, so I'm going to get to see this, right?
I just don't.
Although they know begged what to me say. Constantly to upgrade them to 11, but now I've got a reason to hold out, because seeing more bad sources of news on my lock screen really excites me.
So there's still a lot of Windows 10 users out there. Is that the reason?
Oh, yes. There are at least 500 million of them. I mean, there's probably more.
Mostly
on 10, not 11.
Yeah. Right.
Especially in the business side of things.
this figure is probably not accurate anymore, but for quite a while, it was kind of a two-thirds, one-third split between supported versions of Windows, where two-thirds was Windows 10. I think that's finally starting to come down. But the majority of people running Windows today are running Windows 10.
So why aren't they doing more testing then on Windows 10? That's kind of surprising.
Well, because remember, they weren't going to introduce any new features. Once they introduced the end of support date, they kind of said, look, we're going to just keep supporting this version of Windows 10 now, and we're not going to add any new features. That one they actually came out and said publicly, like, this wasn't just a random guy saying it. Microsoft, this was policy.
Yeah.
And they're
playing chicken with their users.
This happens a lot.
It's a game. It is a game. There are no winners. It's a weird game. It's they should
just continue. No winners, only winners.
Yeah. In the end, the cash cow is still the enterprise. And if the right enterprise customer says, oh, we'll be staying on 10.
We'll be staying on 10, and we expect sports, traffic, and finance cards on the lock screen. Be a shame if something happened to all this business you're getting.
Right. It is that kind of a relationship. I feel like we always find out in the end why things happen, but they're always confusing at the time. Mm-hmm. One of the things that changed between Windows 10 and 11 is that Microsoft stopped syncing your desktop wallpaper when you signed in with a Microsoft account or a corporate account. And on the face of things, that doesn't make a lot of sense. That was probably the number one request for sync, you know, that as a user, when you go to a new device, you have this familiar experience because there's your wallpaper and your color scheme and all that stuff. And then what I learned years later was that there was a big corporate customer who switched between Dell and PCs and went to HP. And when they synced everyone up, they had Dell wallpapers. And HP called Microsoft and said, turn that off now. And they did. They got rid of it.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, I mean, retroactively, you can kind of look at something and say, okay, I don't agree with it necessarily, but okay, that makes sense. Maybe that's kind of a a blunt way of, you know, fixing a problem, I guess. I mean, it seems like you could put a little policy there or something, but whatever. Okay. So Windows 10 is now an ongoing concern again. And I think it's tied to Copilot. I think Microsoft really did for 10 seconds intend not to update Windows 10 ever again. But then they realized, hey, wait a minute, we got to get Copilot out in the world. And if we tie it to Windows 11 version, whatever, no one's going to upgrade. And oh, by the way, what about Windows 10? We got to get it over there too. And that was the end of that policy. I think they just said, we're going to get this out to everybody. And that's how we're going to do it. So now we're testing minor features, but you know, not to dredge up, speaking of PTSD, Windows Phone, but I mean, Windows or Live Tiles made sense on a phone. This at-a-glance thing made sense. We were always looking at our phone. We can find out things without having to dive into apps. That made sense. They brought Live Tiles to Windows, and it never made sense, right? Like, we don't use our PCs that same way. And putting these types of things on a lock screen is very similar. You know, I don't think that people walk up to their computer, wake it up, look at the lock screen, and go, yeah, no, I don't need to use it anymore. I know what the weather is. You know, I just don't see the value in this personally.
I love the ADD effect, you know, that started back at Win 8. It's like, click me. No, click me. Look, I'm twitching the most. Click me.
Well, this is like, but yes, there was a lot of bumping and bobbing and that kind of stuff, animations and whatever. But, you know, then they move it to back to a start menu. And now we have Live Tiles on an interface that's never on screen all the time. And it's like, guys, you know, think about it. No, what are you going to do? I want to know what the weather is. So I'm going to do Windows key plus L to lock the computer, look at the lock screen and say, now I know what the weather is. And then I'm going to type in my PIN or password, however I sign in, you know. I don't know what this is. Was it college intern week at Microsoft last week or something? I have no idea.
You know, that was my first thought when I saw this. It's like, oop, the intern got loose. They wouldn't let him work on 11, so they let him work on 10.
Yeah. So at the time I wrote these notes, which was about 10 minutes ago, there were no new builds, but now there are. And there was a, you know, they're doing things on Wednesdays, like I said. So Canary and Dev, again, on the same build. And there are two changes, and one of them has to do with low vision users. So that's just a temporary setback. There was a pointer indicator accessibility setting for low vision users that they've disabled temporarily because it's too buggy. And then there's some, in the same vein, in some ways, there are assistive there are Bluetooth-based assistive hearing device capabilities that are now available. So I guess we've gone from one accessibility feature to the other. And then some other bugs related to shutdown, hibernation, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the problems that have dogged Windows ever since there's been something called Windows. I'm pretty sure that the phrase hot bagging exists solely because Windows is a thing. But yeah, so I guess we're still dealing with that kind of stuff. And that's it.
Wow, that's the quickest Windows section I think we've had in a while.
We'll dive in and out of Windows a little bit as we go forward. But yeah, that's
it. There really is a case to be moving to Thursday if they're going to keep releasing on Wednesday. I mean, really.
Richard's like, listen, Thursday. It'll have to be before my show because I've got Tech News Weekly on Thursdays already.
You can move to Wednesday, Micah. We'll swap. We can swap.
We can swap.
Have I mentioned how much I hate change?
You don't have to mention it, Paul. You exude.
Is it obvious? Oh, I'm sorry. No, I actually have a tattoo.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. Might as well. It's your aura.
Most people have change with a circle and a line through it.
Yours is just like your aura just says, don't change.
You know how I feel about this.
the IT saying is, change is good. You go first.
Ooh, yeah, exactly. I like that. Well, then let's move into Microsoft 365, given that that's the new hotness anyway, as Richard says.
Windows is technically within Microsoft 365 now, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a great point, that Windows had to join another group to be relevant.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, eventually they'll just hand off Windows to the part of the company that makes like Furbies or whatever little, what do you call those things? Plushmallows or whatever.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Squishmallows, whatever they call.
Kevin knew.
It'll be the intern center. Right.
The intern center. Yes. Right. Right.
It's like, you're only going to be here 3 months. So we're going to make you work on Windows.
This isn't the Microsoft campus. This is the college campus. Shut up. You're working on Windows. Okay.
Everybody has to pay their dues. You will deploy something into Windows.
Yeah, right. The bar is low. So one of the big controversies, I guess, as Microsoft moved from kind of perpetual Office to the subscriptions with Office 365 and now Microsoft 365, is that there were obviously customers that don't want any part of that. And so Microsoft they've been pretty consistent about this. We're going to have this, what they call the perpetual versions of Office. These are the versions that you buy outright. You own them. They have a support life cycle. You can install them on multiple computers. In recent years, they've made them less desirable, but not by not updating them with new features over time. Although some people might argue that's a benefit.
I think some customers demanded that.
Yeah.
Stop moving things.
Yeah.
Because they hate change.
I get it.
When you're an IT guy, every one of those changes gets turned into support tickets.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. And so it's money, right? You know what your average cost per ticket is. Yeah. And so you know how many you get in. It's like, yeah, you just cost me 20 grand.
I feel like, but I hear you. I mean, you're right. I'm not disagreeing. But on the other hand, one of the things that Microsoft did that sort of infamously was, this was probably post Office 95, Office 97, maybe whatever year it was they worked to make all the toolbars on each Office app be as familiar or as similar as possible. The idea being that somehow if you were a, like a Word user, you could pick up Excel. And because most of the toolbars were the same, you'd be like, oh, I can use this product, and what they really found, and there was no actual user testing or any research that it just sounded right, And what we found is that, people adapt, you can use this kind of complicated UI in Windows and then use an Android phone or an iPhone or an iPad or something. And they don't work in a similar way at all. And you just, it's fine. It just works fine. So I don't know what the real training costs are moving between Office 2019 or whatever it is in Office 2024, which is the next version or whatever. I don't know. Are they really that different? I don't know. I really don't know. But
and you use that support ticket number to figure out how much you're going to spend on training.
Yeah.
Right.
So whatever the reason, Microsoft's customers have demanded these perpetual things persist, and they do, right? And so I think we've all suspiciously wondered when are they going to cut it off? You know, it's coming. You know, this is the last one, but they've sort of soldiered along. Like 2019 came and went, 2021 is the current version. They announced this past week there will be a 2024, right? And there will, in fact, be a long-term servicing channel version of Office 2024. So
how long is long now?
Yeah, 5 minutes. No, I don't. Yeah. I think they're both 5 years.
Okay, where they used to be 10.
10 years.
And in dev right. Now, you can't get anything over 3.
Yeah.
Okay, 5.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's welcome to 2024. I don't know. So the big change this year, or for this version of the product, is that Microsoft now has Copilot, right? So they have these Copilot capabilities. It's not so much that they're adding new features every single month, although yes, they are, but rather that a lot of those new features are now part of Copilot, which is this added subscription thing. And in the case of Copilot Pro and Copilot for Microsoft 365, you get these capabilities in the Microsoft desktop apps, web apps, probably mobile apps eventually, that you don't get if you don't pay for that subscription, regardless of the fact that you might have a Microsoft 365 subscription. So these perpetual versions of the product will not support that. You couldn't just buy Office 2024 and then pay for a Copilot Pro subscription, let's say, and get the additional functionality from Copilot. Now, I know what some people are thinking. They're smiling and saying, good, I don't want Copilot. I love that there's a version of Office that doesn't have Copilot. And actually, I got to be honest, I hear you. Because in the same way that Office, I use Word primarily, like Word on Windows kind of badgers you with these little pop-up banners if you don't use OneDrive or save things in a certain way or blah, 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 whatever. Office on the Mac, Micah, you may have seen this, actually you may not because you probably don't pay for it, I guess. But if you pay for Copilot, Copilot appears in the middle of the screen every time you start a document. You can't turn this off.
Oh, that's frustrating.
You've got to be kidding me. So I've configured this app how I want it. It doesn't go to some template thing. It goes right into a new document. I can save to the desktop. It does not badger me about that. But it does put up a Copilot thing right in the beginning, right in the middle of the screen that I have to, click. And I think you can hit escape probably and get rid of it. But it's cannot.
Still there. There is, right. You can't.
There
just
is
say,
no
don't
feature.
Show
this. There's no way to turn. Yeah. Yeah.
All modal dialogues are evil. Right. Like the bottom.
I think part of it is honestly just the newness of it. I think they wanted to rush it out, get it out there, and that as people provide feedback, they'll be like,
we'll call it Dell wallpaper. Right. Like Dell wallpaper.
There's an argument to be made, too. People will complain about discoverability of new features in the opposite sense that, you didn't know they were there and you go find them. Hopefully, like you're saying, Paul, it's a temporary thing where eventually.
Well, but
it'll get.
So you've just described a problem that's already been solved, which is, yes, I respect Microsoft's desire and need to allow people to discover this feature. But it also should have a button that says, don't ever show me this again.
Yeah. Listen, I have discovered it and I have found it wanting.
I got it. Lost. Yep. I see what you're doing. Thank you. Don't ever show me that again. Yeah. No, they don't do it. And they don't do it on Windows either. So
you can always tell when there's sysadmins in the room and they're announcing a new feature. Because the very first question out of every admin's mouth is, how do I turn it off?
What happens ask it? How do I make you go away?
What I did is I asked Google, and as it turns out, there is no way to turn this off. So, and I've looked through the UI, and on the flip side, by the way, just Word, Windows or Mac, there is a very prominent Copilot button that appears now, and in Windows at least, there's a pane that can appear. I like to turn off the ribbon, right? But there's something called, I think it's called the Quick Access Toolbar, if I'm not mistaken, and you can add your little buttons to it. There's no way to add the Copilot button to that, right? So I would want to turn off the ribbon, basically hide the ribbon. But I would put the Copilot button up there because actually sometimes I would like to use it.
That's a good place for it, yeah.
And they don't offer that. And again, I think these are tied to the same bit of immaturity. It's just this thing just arrived. They wanted to get it out quickly. They haven't maybe thought through all the use cases. And hopefully both those things will occur. I want to add it here and I want to take it away here. I want this thing to work the way I want it to work, which I guess was what I spent an hour on last week. So I'll move on. anywho, so Office Perpetual 2024, you're not getting AI. I'd sort of just mentioned this in passing, but I guess this is, oh, this is the web app. So that's why. I'm sorry. So Microsoft 365 has supported a Copilot, right, for some time. If you have those apps, desktop apps, Windows or Mac, I guess, because I have Copilot Pro, you also get those capabilities. But now they work on the web apps as well. So in other words, you're paying for a Microsoft 365 subscription of any kind, or not, actually, right? Because you could use those for free. No, you have to, but you have to have one to get the other subscription. Sorry, I'm forgetting things here. But anyway, the point is you can now access the Copilot capabilities in the primary Office web apps, as we used to call them, if you have a Copilot Pro subscription as well, right? So in the past, you needed a Copilot for Microsoft 365, I guess, but now it also works with the Copilot Pro. And if that doesn't make sense, what I just said, that's because you speak English and I don't know what to tell you. It's confusing. But this is that matrix of features things I was talking about, right? It's hard enough in an app like Word, which is available in multiple places, right? Mobile, different mobile apps, different iPad apps and Word, I'm sorry, Windows and Mac and the web. And one day, randomly, they add some fee. I used the transcription example two, three years ago, added it to the web version. That thing didn't come to Windows for at least 2 years, you know? And you can create a matrix of like, here are all the features in this one product. Where do they appear? And this is an example of that with AI and Copilot, because I believe that the web apps for Microsoft 365 supported Copilot if you paid for Copilot for Microsoft 365. And now they support Copilot Pro as well. So you can check that little box off in the matrix and maybe you sunk my battleship. I don't know. it's complicated, right? And on the free side, this one's confusing because they didn't really announce it, although a guy who works on the team did on Twitter, or X, or whatever we're calling it, the Century. Microsoft, when they released Copilot Pro, made a slider available in Copilot for ChatGPT-4 and ChatGPT-4 Turbo. Now that ChatGPT-4 Turbo is available for non-paying users, so if you just go to copilot.microsoft.com or Copilot in Windows 10, presumably, or Copilot in the Edge sidebar, presumably. I have to say presumably because no one's ever announced these things and there's no way to actually know, but there is, they're just using ChatGPT-4 Turbo by default. So it's more up to date, which is important for certain types of queries, as I think of them, or prompts or whatever. This guy said there would be a switch, which I actually haven't. Well, I see because I'm paying for it, right? But I don't believe people have seen yet. And then I guess it only appears in certain cases. So, you know, they have, they don't use this term, but personalities or whatever, where it can be creative or balanced or precise, right? If you want it balanced, I think it's balanced and creative or probably GPT-4 Turbo and precise is GPT-4 or something like that. Or, you know, it will switch between the models based on various conditions and then sometimes probably switch back to one or the other based on usage maybe. But I think the primary advantage of GPT-4 for Microsoft, Turbo rather, for Microsoft is that it's less expensive to run. So I think that was a big part of moving it down to the non-paying customers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And you're also seeing they're getting some new computational efficiencies. So, yeah, I think you hit it on the head. It's all a cost control thing. Like, I'm already collecting your money now. So I want to spend as little as I can on that while still staying ahead. So it's that balancing act.
There was talk early on, too, about complaints, I remember, surrounding ChatGPT-4 becoming lazy, which at the time was a suggestion that it was not answering prompts as often and sometimes just outright saying that it wouldn't answer them and that Turbo was supposed to help correct that. So it certainly gives it gives a better understanding of why maybe they chose that name along with, as you're saying, the performance nature of ChatGPT-4 Turbo.
I'll see that sometimes. You know, you type in something and it says, "Yeah, I'm sorry, we can't do that." I'm like, "Yeah, you can.
You totally can. We know you can.
Let's try it again. I believe in you."
Yeah, there you go.
It's going to be all right. You can do it.
I assume, Richard, this has been a big thing in your world. And yes. I have to say, I have not been I have not been pushed hard on something like this in the enterprise side of things in a long time. I have to go back to my days at Windows IT Pro, mm-hmm. but I Google has reached out to me multiple times about this. Amazon did recently, where there's this other battleground occurring in the EU around big tech, aside from all the stuff we know about, like mm-hmm. Apple app stores and the gatekeeper stuff and all that. And it really is just a long-term issue in Europe around data sovereignty and sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And sovereignty. There you go.
There we go.
I don't understand English either. And data privacy and all that kind of stuff. And you know, these cloud vendors over the years have worked to make sure that people can keep their data within their region or within their country, yada, yada, yada. So the new battle is, well, there's twofold. There's the licensing practice by which Microsoft makes it difficult, allegedly, to move customers between different clouds, right? They want to keep you in Azure. And a big part of that is this thing called egress fees. The idea is that I'm ready to leave, or at least I want to leave partially. I want to move some of my data to one of the other clouds. And I think really because of regulatory pressure, Google and AWS over time agreed to end those fees, right? And they've been calling on Microsoft very vocally to do the same. And Microsoft has resisted. Actually, Amazon resisted for a while too. If my mm-hmm. memory serves, Google did this in January. AWS did it about 10 seconds ago. So Microsoft just did it too. So that's the rough timing.
And it's because they were headed towards legislation and they didn't want
the They were going to, yes, they were going to be slapped down. Yep.
It's not just moving between clouds. It's also what they're calling repatriation.
Yeah.
Oh. So as people,
right. In other words, yeah, make sure the data comes out of a particular locale and gets back to.
Oh, I'm going to put it. I want to move it back on prem because it's costing me too much in the cloud, right. Which may be, you know, your fault or their fault. Like there's a whole debate here of this lift and shift that happened over the pandemic, which has now turned into a bunch of monthly bills that continue to grow. And so CFOs are sort of pushing back and one of the solutions, rather than re-architecting your software to be more efficient in the cloud, is just ship it home. Right. But then you look at the egress fees and say, this is a barrier to that. And it's like, mm-hmm. well, that's just wrong. Let's see if we can get legislation to knock it out. And which clearly was happening. So, you know, it's not a bad, there is no excuse for egress fees, really.
Yeah. Right. 100%. Yeah. Predatory. I mean, I think.
Unless you're going to put in ingress fees. You know, at least make it cost you go in and cost you go out.
That's interesting. Ingress fees. This is everyone else is doing it. Defense is pretty common in big tech. I think that explains app store fees, actually. Mm-hmm. But it also explains
charging for luggage, right? Like and fuel surcharges. And like it's a kind of pseudo monopolistic practice. Well, everybody else is doing it, so we get to do it too.
Yeah. I mean, that was also, there was an economist who argued that it wasn't any lack of profit on big tech's mm-hmm. side that resulted in the mass layoffs that took place, but more it was shaped by that herd mentality that you mm-hmm. saw one company do it, so you did it too. And it was two things. One, that herd mentality, but also then it brought those companies up in terms of the investors who were going, ooh, you're costing less money, so this is great.
Yeah, it was a cheap way to get a stock bump at a time when you didn't have a lot of new product to talk about.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I can't prove the second half of it, but the notion that these guys were not suffering from a profit or revenue perspective is easily proven.
One you know, banner quarter that's after fact. Another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What? Yep. Yep. One banner quarter, just one right after the other.
Yep. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Let's take another quick pause mm-hmm. as we come back with AI next. All right, we are back with Windows Weekly, the show where we talk to two of the foremost Windows veterans. It is Paul Thurrott, Richard Campbell, and I join the two of them, Micah Sargent, as we continue on in the coverage of what's up at Microsoft and, well, the surrounding companies as well. Because I believe we start by talking about Apple.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm trying to shift the focus of the show a little bit to Apple. So this is just, testing the waters.
Just stopped listening.
No,
come back.
What?
There's a Microsoft angle to this. But honestly, there's also a common sense angle to this because I think it was Mark Gurman broke the story. The New York Times has since, confirmed it. But Apple looked at partnering with OpenAI and now are very deep into talks with Google to partner with them to bring Gemini to the iPhone and use that to power a lot of their generative AI experiences that will come in that next version of iOS this fall. So we're probably going to learn about whatever they do at WWDC, whenever that is in June. And then they'll start releasing new products and the new versions of the OS in the fall. And look, I'm not, I don't exactly have 2 feet in the Apple ecosystem, but you don't have to be paying too much attention to hear the outrage and shock that these two companies, which allegedly hate each other, would partner on this kind of a thing. And I had a different reaction to this, which was, I don't think you guys are paying attention. You know, Apple has actually a very rich history of partnering for this kind of a product launch. They have a rich history of getting rid of their partners as quickly as possible, too. But this we've seen this story before, right? I mean, this notion that you would partner with like an enemy, essentially, right? That they would betray you, you know, and then you would sue them. And or sue somebody, I guess, this public bitterness, you know, you talk about destroying each other and then there's a reunion at the end is what happened with Apple and Microsoft when Microsoft helped Apple create part of the original Mac UI and then created Windows and they sued and blah, 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 whatever. And then Apple needed Microsoft again in 1997 to keep making Office and help rescue the company financially and blah. We all know that story, right? But the other thing is with Google and Apple specifically, I don't think people understand the dynamic there. I mean, everyone remembers the Steve Jobs, I'm going to go thermonuclear war and destroy this company because Android is a stolen product, right? But I hope we also remember that they never actually sued Google, right? I mean, no. They went after, you know, Samsung, which is a crappy company that absolutely copied the design of various iPhones. And that wound its way down. I mean,
that didn't work out well either, you know.
But they didn't get much out of it. But the real story there is that for all the posturing, for all of the we made Apple Maps and now we're coming after search kind of stuff that we hear about, these guys have the most lucrative partnership in big tech today, right? Google paid Apple as much as $20-something billion last year to keep search on the iPhone as the default. And that's only 36% of the revenues that they made from it.
Yeah.
This is a partnership that benefits both of them. Of course, these two guys are going to partner on this. It's the same exact thing.
Well, and Tim Cook's no dummy. Yeah. Somebody's done the numbers on what they were going to have to build out infrastructure to run their own large language models. And he went,
let's let Google do that. With. How does that sound?
Yeah. Well, and Google needs the data, which is why the search thing works too. Like it's all mutually beneficial.
Yes. There are other ways that Apple and Google kind of co-benefit each other that are a little less direct. You know, for example, I mentioned in passing this App Store thing. You know, Apple arbitrarily does whatever they do with the App Store, but then Google just copies them like 100%. Mm-hmm. And it gives them both that, well, the other guy's doing it, you know, like they must be doing it for a reason. It's the same reason we're doing it. You know, like I think there's a strategy there. And Apple, promotes itself on privacy and blah, 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 whatever. But the fact remains, I mean, Google search is the default and it's not staying on your iPhone. I'm sorry.
Right,
like exactly. It's just not like that's the biggest marketing nonsense of all time. So These are two big, horrible companies like Microsoft, like Amazon, like all these other guys, they're all horrible. And I think, you know, we need to get past these kind of mythological, immature ideals that we think this, you know, that somehow one of these companies is like better than the other, you know, and I fell for that. I'm human too. Like I thought that Microsoft under Satya Nadella was some kind of ethical higher ground, something. And that is not the case. It just isn't, you know, so I this is maybe a growth moment for all of us, but these guys partnering on Gemini for the iPhone to me makes sense. And Apple being Apple will market it appropriately. And we'll probably take very real steps to contort it in some way that it makes sense for iPhone and for iPhone users, right?
Yeah, sure.
And
they'll amplify it. That's it.
They'll amplify it, yeah.
But it also doesn't preclude them making a deal with Microsoft sometime in the future.
Yes.
And I can't blame Microsoft for not wanting to be in on this one.
That's the angle that kind of bugs me. When I look at big tech companies, I made this case about Google and Microsoft, you know, hating each other, and when they should be in fact standing with each other against Apple, I mean, you can make that case with Apple and Microsoft too. Apple relies on Microsoft Office still to some degree. It's still an important part of their marketing, right? It runs on the Mac, you know, by the way, it runs on the iPhone.
All of these things happen to stand up
against Google.
Yeah, Microsoft and Google partnered to push Safari to be compliant with the WebAssembly standards. Like, this does happen. They all play this dance.
Yeah.
Protecting each their various markets while trying to limit the other guy and making sure they get to play in certain other spaces. I wouldn't want to take on Apple's LLM workload right now.
Right.
Because you know, by the way they control their customers, they're going to get nailed.
And there is an example from history of that. Think back to Singular, or I guess it was AT&T by that point.
Yeah, look what happened to AT&T.
The iPhone, even the small number of iPhone users that were there that first year brought that network to its knees. Just on 2G, or 2.5. What was it called? Edge or whatever. That was a huge problem.
Microsoft is onboarding M365 Copilot people as fast as they can. They're consuming enough of their own resources. This is not the time to introduce another workload.
It raises the specter that maybe they did ask Microsoft, and Microsoft's like, yeah, we can't do that.
Call us in a couple of years.
Yep, we're done. Yeah. But I do like the idea of Apple or any other company, but Apple especially, I think, because of the way they kind of market their stuff, is taking the best from whatever's out there and making this thing for iPhone users that is more bespoke, or whatever we call it, bespoke AI.
Yeah, especially.
And if I'm a real, go ahead, Ryan.
I was just going to say, especially from my understanding of how they're kind of partnering with Google, and forgive me if you did mention this part, it is they're doing as much of the stuff that they can do, or that I should say that it can do, that Apple can do on device, AI stuff, and then what it can't do, it's farming it out to Google. Well, according to all of this, and I find that interesting. What's going to be done locally versus what they will use Google potentially for.
So this hasn't come up recently, but maybe this wasn't something we discussed while you were on the show. But I have raised this idea in the past. I mean, honestly, Apple's biggest contribution to the AI space to date has been this notion of doing as much as you can on the device. Mm-hmm. And that thing has been copied by other companies on other platforms. And I do think because of the expense of this cloud-based AI, that we generative AI, that some combination of on device and in the cloud is in some ways this optimal kind of hybrid configuration. And I think, I don't thank Apple for that or whatever. I mean, Apple did it for its own reasons.
Right,
and
exactly.
To address its own limitations or whatever. But they some insight came out of that. And I think that's the thing we all accept. We're trying to figure out what AI looks like with an MPU on a PC right now. We just mentioned this briefly. We're trying to make that model make sense, on the PC. We just don't. It's easy on a phone, I think, because you have these use cases where you're like, yes, I would like to remove that person from the back of the photo or whatever it might be, or, some speech translation thing or whatever it might be. Like, there are certain things that just because your phone is in your pocket all the time, you always have, like, it makes sense to, have stuff that works on the device, right? Mm-hmm. It's not always a good idea to go to the cloud for everything because you don't always have good connectivity. Like, you want that experience to be consistently good or whatever. So I think we should credit Apple for that. So we'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah. So we know that Build is in May. We know now that Google I/O is also in May 14. And we know Apple WWDC is always in June. They haven't announced the show yet, but they will soon. And this is the same every spring as developer show season, right? I/O, Build, WWDC back to back. And you could expect all of these shows to be all AI all the time. Uh-huh. There's no doubt about it.
It has overwhelmed the conversation, for better or worse.
Yes, it has. Yep. Yeah, I had some, Apple for several years probably has been marketing what we now think of as AI capabilities on its phones as they would talk about machine learning, right? That was kind of the way they would describe it. And today the conversation has shifted to generative AI or just people say AI or whatever. And, Apple's on board, right? I mean, they announced that new MacBook Air And it is the AI PC. Mm-hmm. It's like, yikes, guys, seriously. Like, but you know what? Whatever. That's the language you're using. It's fine. And I do think that this stuff, these developer shows, there will be other AI capabilities, obviously. But I think for end user benefit, the thing that people kind of understand is what we would call generative AI, right? I think this is the biggest, this is what ChatGPT is, right?
Yeah, generative AI over the stuff that is so far in the background. You know, we talk about at the chip level, some of the decisions, so to speak, that the chip is making. Yeah. There's AI packed in there. There's the AI, the technical AI that helps sort a dog from a cat. There's AI and spell checking. Yeah, there's AI
and spell checking.
Exactly. It's all of that. But yeah, the AI that they're trying to market now, as you say, is Gen AI or generative AI for sure.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's the big push this year. So I think I we're going to see a lot of that. I mean, there will be, obviously, there always is. I mean, how long has Apple had something that I'm sure is called AI Kit, right? They have this. I assume they do, right? AI Kit. That must be a thing. No,
I
should
think
be. It will be. If it isn't, it will be.
Like VR Kit, only different.
Yeah. You know they're going to have it if they
think,
don't already.
I think
right?
it's but ML. That's why.
ML. Yeah. Oh, that's why. They're going to change it because that's a terrible name. So, but yeah, anyway. And then tomorrow, speaking of bad timing, Microsoft is hosting an AI and Surface event. And then now we know they're hosting another one in May, right before Build. So our best guess for now is that the one that's happening tomorrow is kind of business focus. And we've heard rumors of, Qualcomm-based computers coming, the new ones, right, based on the Elite X chipset. And that must be May. And I guess that's how we're splitting things up. So we'll see what happens.
I can see doing
tomorrow.
This ahead of Google I.O. to try and beat messaging on Google I.O.
Yeah,
but if you're doing it after Google I.O., like, do it at Build. Like, what is this?
The event tomorrow, you mean?
No, the event in May.
In May. So when is what Build is after I.O., isn't it?
It is. No, yeah. It's after. It is the week of May 20th. So maybe this is actually going to be at Build.
I think it's right before. I think it's right on the, I'm sure what it is there's like a private event before Build, I think. And then
they'll
probably
Build starts
it'll be part of the
day.
Keynote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there'll probably be some overlap on the two, but they'll do some.
So the rumors are that we're going to get, business Surface devices tomorrow and then consumer devices in May.
It's weird.
Yeah. And they've talked about Intel on one side and Qualcomm on the other. Right. And is it possible that the year of the ARM PC will happen before the year of desktop Linux? We're going to find out. I don't know.
Well, if they announce ARM hardware just before Build, then Build needs to be about ARM hardware.
Yeah. Right?
Because it's going to be devs that are going to make that work.
That's my guess. I mean, that's based on rumors, right? I mean, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So we shall see. So we got those to look forward to. And then, 6 days later when it's not even fresh anymore, we'll talk about it on Windows Week. Because fantastic. All right, what else we got here? So apparently NVIDIA now has a developer show every year. I don't know if you saw already the clips from this, but...
it was quite the rock show, wasn't it?
Yep. That's what he said. He goes, I don't know if you guys thought you were at a Taylor Swift concert or something, but this is a developer show.
Yeah, Jeff Jarvis and I covered the event live.
Okay.
Yeah. And yes, it was, exactly what you said. It was a...
It's funny.
It was
in rock show vibes.
Very, very jargon heavy, very in-depth, very much... getting into the nitty gritty. And I found that interesting as someone who's used to more consumer facing keynote presentations.
Yeah. No, it almost had a WinHack feel, right? Like once upon a time, Microsoft did events specifically for the driver and hardware builders.
That's exactly right.
And their keynotes were geeky. And this had that buzz about it. It's like you need to be to be in this room.
I just gave Apple some credit for doing whatever they did, but I think we can blame Apple for this effect because Microsoft's developer shows, Microsoft's Ignite, show for IT pros, et cetera. The keynote has turned into a marketing event on day one because of the success Apple's had doing the same thing. My wife could watch a WWC keynote and think nothing of it other than, oh my God, do these guys love Apple too much? What's happening?
Right.
But I mean, she wouldn't feel out of place. Like it doesn't feel like a developer show. That show is a developer show and there's lots of developer stuff that happens there. But Yeah, I think that we might be looking at the, well, this isn't, you know, NVIDIA flexing their muscles on the one hand, but also, I mean, I kind of like the old school nature of what they're doing, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I kind of miss this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was cool.
I also think, they're a little panic struck to stay in front. Like these big water cooled units they're building. Right. That's I don't have time to build a refined thing, so let's just
so I'm going to put this in. Right.
Well, and I thought it was a good remind. The company took the time to do its, I think, a bit of a stage bow, saying, "Y'all have been talking about all of this Gen AI stuff, and you're so excited about what Microsoft is doing, and what we are making so much of the hardware that's already running that stuff.
Yeah,
and we are at the root of all of that. Don't forget us." Mm-hmm. I did find it very inspirational to see the CEO of a company clearly know so much about what the company is making.
Like, he is
that was
cool. He's very technical. Yeah, he's a cool guy.
Proper engineer CEO.
There is still an element of they waltzed into this, and he tried to make the case like, oh no, this is the strategy all along, and it's like you were making video graphic computers.
Yeah,
not really.
Yeah,
I'm just disappointed he didn't go with the liquid nitrogen additions. Like, if you're gonna go for it,
look, God love him. And the harsh reality today, and to keep bringing up the MPU thing, is that all of the local AI, forget about the cloud for a moment. I mean, all of the local AI workloads that exist today are tuned for GPUs. So, I mean, maybe one day MPUs will be better at this, and maybe it won't matter. I mean,
well,
maybe
they're also just not that different. Right.
Like, yeah,
really.
Okay.
They're both scalar processors. It's not that big of a deal. Well, you know, we've already been harnessing GPUs through CUDA and the like to do other kind of scalar workloads like image recognition and things. Like, this is not that weird. Right. So, you know, the joke has been, so what is your MPU? Like, why is that different from my GPU? Why do I need to buy something else? Because architecturally, it's just not that far
I think
apart.
We can blame Apple for that again, because obviously you need another device.
You need something to sell.
That's the strategy.
And Cook is a hardware guy. Yeah. Arguably, the MPU is simpler, right?
Yes.
Like, scalar pipelines for ray tracing are a complicated bit of kit. And what NVIDIA has done is incredibly innovative. It's very, very powerful. And you don't really need it if you're simply doing neural network work.
Right. I mean, Microsoft is doing everything they can to remove their dependency on NVIDIA right now, right?
Which is kind of humorous. They with the Cobalt processors and so forth. I mean, everybody's building their own hardware.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense. Don't create a dependency where you don't need to. And don't, you know, that $1 trillion valuation is cost for you. Like, you go keep that money. Whether or not they can keep up is another question entirely. Like, I don't know how long stay around.
As a long-term Microsoft follower, I can tell you from experience that inertia is a wonderful thing from a business perspective. And right now, NVIDIA is in a sweet spot. We don't know if this is the apex and they're on the way down or if this is still on the way up somehow. But the reality is, regardless of what happens going forward with whatever chipsets people or companies choose, whatever it is, they built up enough capital and influence.
You need to execute on it now. I would point out that clearly Jensen's paid for a stylist once, but he's been using the same keynote outfit now for multiple shows.
Like, oh, really?
It's time to get another style. Oh, yeah. No, the black T-shirt, black leather jacket thing, that's the same look from Build last year.
That's funny.
Yeah. You should update. If you want to level this up, like we talk about in this land of rock star CEOs, you should use the same look twice. Like, there should be a stylist on call. It should be a point.
I mean, we have to blame Steve Jobs for this.
No, because black turtleneck and baggy and dad pant and dad jeans. Like,
dad jeans. I would call them mom jeans, but fair enough. It's whatever they were. It's a look. You get a look, you know, I don't know.
No. And I think this is very tech thing. It's like you paid for it once to create a look. You hung it up in that. You ordered seven of them.
Exactly.
Hang them in the closet. Seven of them.
Right. Unlike me, what I want our customers to do is upgrade all the time. I'm going to stick with the same
thing. I've got 15 of these jackets.
You open the closet and it's just all this black leather.
Just, it's just black T-shirts.
Is this a dungeon or what is this? Oh, this is your closet.
Is this a dungeon? Oh, dear.
Well, Guthrie only wears a red polo shirt. Like, I'm not saying it's anything special to Jensen.
Which is funny, because like, if you see him out in the world and he's not wearing that, he's like, he's camouflage. You don't even notice him.
He's almost unrecognizable.
Yeah.
There's
a digression.
I do enjoy that we spent more time on his clothing than we did on the products. But anyway, that's okay.
They spent plenty of time on the product.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and the products are kicking it. Like, no two ways about it. I hope they can keep up the rate of innovation. We will be better for it, because what's happening in CPUs is not that exciting. We need to go to dedicated processing units for different workloads. Like, that's what makes sense in the evolution of the silicon at this point. So it is good news.
All right. What's next?
Anyway. All righty. And then just random other generative AI things. You know, I saw this headline and I thought to myself, I don't know if I want to write about this, but Google is adding generative AI to Fitbit. And I actually looked into it, by which I mean, I actually watched the event that made this reference. And I said, you know what? Actually, this makes sense.
This makes sense in a lot of other things. This is where the way most gen AI should be used, which is to make existing products better. Yep.
Well, but of course, see, this is health and fitness, right? So you want to be careful here. Like, you don't want an AI recommending like a recipe thing could kill you, right? If you do it wrong, right? If they recommend the wrong things.
Yeah.
But actually, if you think about how Fitbit works today, which is by measuring a lot of data and presenting charts and graphs and trends and things, using generative AI to summarize that, maybe graph it or present it graphically, and allowing you to ask questions of it, is very interesting. And actually, there was a line, the woman who presented this at the Google event used a line that gave me an immediate flashback to the Microsoft Band, which people watching the show might remember.
Yes,
and the original Yep. The original promise of this device, which arrived at a time when these wearables and the Apple Watch, I think it maybe had just come out or something, didn't have a lot in the way of sensors. And the idea of the Microsoft Band was, we're going to collect as much data as we can. It was like, it looked like the probe droid, what do you call it? The little interrogator bot thing from the first Star Wars movie, you know, kind of comes in on Princess Leia, and it's got all these little needles and whatever. And the idea was, we're going to grab as much as we can. At the time, it was a crazy amount of sensors. Now today it's common, but back then it was a big deal.
And it was so ahead of
time. And we're going to collect all this data and we're going to present you with this, you know, information based on all the data. But the promise, and they never fulfilled this, was, we as Microsoft have all of your work related info. So we have this stuff about your productivity and your kind of work day. And now we're collecting this data about your health and, you know, health, well, we call it health data through a band. And we can actually put that together and say, hey, you have this Monday morning meeting every week, and your heart rate, resting heart rate, goes through the roof 30 minutes before that meeting. So we're going to recommend that you, you know, do meditation or do something to calm down, maybe stop drinking so much coffee, whatever it might be. And I was like, you know, that sounds like a really neat idea. Now, they never did this. That never happened. They did almost nothing with any of that data. And Microsoft Band came and went, right? They made a second version. They started making a third version that got canceled. It's gone. So whatever, we have Apple Watches and Fitbits now. But they basically were saying the same thing in the Google Health event, where, you know, that Fitbit could, you know, by collecting this information and based on Gemini and yada, yada, all that stuff, that they could offer you some prescriptive was it holistic or heterogeneous data analysis, and say, you know, you've got, same to Google today has all that information too, right? Your Windows Weekly starting in 15 minutes and your heart rate, it's almost like you fall asleep, Paul. Like you're the opposite of a heart attack, or whatever it is. You might want to jog in place for a few minutes, you know, become a little lively or something, whatever it is. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
That's
that seems like a good idea. They're very careful to say, look, we're not prescribing anything. We're not, you know, but they're already really doing this kind of thing in Fitbit. This is just kind of taking it to the next level. And I think it is a good use for generative AI, because this is one of the things it does well, summarize data, right? Or pull out key points from
exactly
a big body of data.
Right? I track a bunch of this stuff a bunch of my health stuff. And that is something that I would like to see more of, more use of all of that information, because I've got, you know, my body temperature, how it changes, plus my activity, plus my heart. I mean, This is so much data, and it only gives me right now. I only have like trends. Oh, you've walked up more flights of stairs this week than you normally do, or your respiration rate is down. I would love to have a more holistic understanding that I could be paired together.
Yes, together. I think there's going to be an explosion, a good kind of explosion, of data related to things like glucose and blood pressure, and combined with, you know, you have an iPhone and you're taking a picture of every meal, and it can use AI to analyze it and figure out basically what it is, and then kind of say, hey, you know, you eat this meal every Wednesday for some reason. Stop doing that. Yeah. It's really bad. You're like,
you know how much salt is days. In this? Yeah.
Well, because we can see it in the data. Like, it takes you days to recover from this meal. Don't do that. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you try that for a couple of weeks, and they can say, all right, we got new data, and you did it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we're already seeing the trends are better for you. Right.
Yeah,
I think this is going to be a huge thing.
And the other side of this is to do the PII safe cross comparisons. People in your age range and your lifestyle and so forth, you sit in this location, you can improve this way. Here's who's had the most success. These persons have done the most success.
I wonder if I can find this quickly. Probably not. But there's a thing somewhere in Fitbit that compares you to other people your age. And in my case, I think it says it's like you. Most people your age are actually dead.
Oh,
so you're doing pretty good.
Good,
something like
it's just
that.
Like a little
I'm paraphrasing.
Good job, Paul.
Yeah, it's just
you're
a little
still alive.
Like, still alive. You're still stood upright today. That's amazing. I don't know how you did it.
Lord.
So, in fact, we'd like to study you. So it's kind of happening already. And then, less excitingly to me, Amazon is, of course, using generative AI now for product page creation for sellers. Right. So if people sell things to the Amazon website, can use generative AI to.
That annoys me.
I don't know what
I'll
to do. I know.
Because, basically they say, okay, I want to sell this thing, and you can put in a little bit of information, and then the thing does the rest.
Right.
Because what I'm not annoyed by is the flip side of that. I have actually very much enjoyed the AI generated summaries.
The summaries, right? Like
reviews.
Yes, exactly.
That's so
I think this is
handy.
One of the greatest uses of AI. Yes. Yep. You see that in Google Maps, I think, for reviews of places and things. It's like people said, .. And it gives you like the top five, whatever comments or whatever.
Great? I love
that's smart. I think it's good. I think it's good.
But
and these are sort of recommendation engine type things, right?
Yeah. This feels like it's just going to be AI on both ends. And it's like,
almost
what,
like
what
this is a, maybe
this?
Not a great. It's almost like an English as a second language thing, which is maybe not the best way to
say
this.
Oh, I see what
this,
you're saying.
But it feels like something. Yeah, it's off. Like it just feels
when
off.
You read
like,
it, it feels like, off. Yeah.
And you show it to somebody, you're like, does this read as English to you? Like, does it make sense? I see the words, but do they go together in that order or whatever?
Does it look like it's been put together by a language model?
It's Uncanny Valley. Right.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely
maybe,
right.
Yeah. Maybe that's
I'm
right
I'll tell you a story that where the names will be left out because they will kill me, but literally a bitter, an ongoing bitter divorce where they've been using ChatGPT to not speak.
I told you
to
not to tell anyone about this. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's not you. to the point now where it both seems super uncanny valley, but at least one of them is now using ChatGPT to deprintify it to say what's actually being said.
No way.
So one of them is escalating it and the other one's
de-escalating it.
Fascinating to me.
Isn't that something?
What I like is that they're going to spend all this money on this. And then at the end, the AI is going to say, like, just split it 50-50. What's wrong with
you? Well, and in this case, it's really the judge. But the whole trick here is that everything the judge is going to read has been prettified and, you know, de-hostilized.
Wow.
That's a word by ChatGPT.
That is interesting. I want this to be
this
a case
is like,
study.
Like you write something like, I think you are the biggest idiot I've ever met. And then AI is like, you have some interesting ideas. Or like, you have but a unique have way of looking at this.
Yeah, exactly.
By which I mean you have the brain of an animal, you know, or whatever. But
you have the brain of a bucket of stones.
Yeah, I've never thought of it that way because I'm educated. But just leave out the end of that, and then it's polite.
I've never thought of it that way. Yeah, exactly.
But then I have a brain in my head, so of course I would.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Now I just want to know everything there is to know about that. All right. Let us head to Xbox Corner that I still think should have a jingle, but, you know, that's just
me.
Only on Xbox.
How about we can go this way?
We're hoping to turn that one around. Give us an Activision Blizzard in a second here.
I could have Copilot create a jingle for Xbox Corner, surely.
Yep. It would be the alien defeat sound and all your base are belong to us.
Yeah. There you go.
Usually twice a month, Microsoft releases some list of Game Pass titles that are coming for those 2 weeks, you know, across console, PC, and cloud, right? And we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for the first Activision Blizzard games, and they've already pre-announced this. Remember, they had that special event. I think it was in February. Yeah, it must have been February for the Xbox. February? I remember. It was a while ago. Who cares? And they announced that the first of those games would be Diablo, but now we're finally getting Diablo 4. Mm. That's finally about to happen. So on March 28th, which is about a week from tomorrow, I guess, we will finally get the first Activision Blizzard game via Xbox Game Pass. And then, of course, we know that going forward, they've promised to do that day and date for all the first party games. So it was something they had said before, but now that, you know, Activision Blizzard is part of Microsoft, they're reiterating that. So as big new titles or any new titles come out through those studios, we'll get them.
It's a current game. It was only released last year. So
yeah. No, right.
They're not doing the back catalog.
Yep. I mean, they will. And honestly, I'm kind of looking forward to it. But
yeah.
But yeah, they're starting with Diablo 4. So that's cool. There's some other good stuff in here. This isn't always the case. Ark Survival Ascended is supposed to be a big game. I've not actually played it. Super Hot, wasn't that one of the first like kind of big modern era VR games, the original version? Was that, am I thinking of the right thing? That kind of raster graphic, I don't know, shooter kind of a thing. But anyway, I'm hoping this is the start of something big. Well, it is the start of something big. I'm just hoping it happens quickly. So now that we're finally in Activision Blizzard Game Pass season, we'll see what happens. So no promises, but it's starting finally. I don't know if anyone follows this. I'm sure there are some people out there who use Microsoft Rewards, right? And so this is the way that Microsoft rewards people for using their products and services, right? I mean, it's a, I don't know, what do you call this kind of a thing? Like a,
it's a like reward a, program, yeah, I guess. Loyalty it's all it is. Card yeah. sort of situation.
Loyalty, yeah. The idea is like, you know, use Bing and like you do, like every day there's like little challenges. You do them and you get some points and then you can turn those points into gifts, right? They turn into money, right? So, you know, you spend 17 hours using Bing and you get like a $5 Microsoft Store gift card or something or whatever it is. There's been weird things going on with Microsoft Rewards over the past few months where people who are very heavy users of it are complaining like the rewards are going down. It's starting to disappear from certain places. It looks like it's about to go away. And then Microsoft's going, no, we're still doing it. You know, so there is today a standalone Microsoft Rewards app on Xbox. They are getting rid of that. In fact, it's happening very quickly. In April, they're going to get rid of it. But that's because there's a new rewards tab. If you go like on the Xbox, hit the white button, the Xbox button, go up to your profile, you'll see there's some tabs there, you know, your games or whatever, your activity. But one of them is now rewards, right? And this is where your Microsoft rewards are. And they're promising, they've actually taken away a few ways that you can earn Microsoft rewards points by doing certain activities. That was like a feature of the app. But they promise they're going to bring at least some of those back, and there's more coming, and you know, whatever, we'll see. But I don't know what the cross section is of people who are active Microsoft Rewards users, I guess, and Xbox fans. But there must be some, right? I mean, I could imagine them basically paying you to use Bing, but I think a lot of Xbox guys just use Xbox, right? They're not doing it for the rewards necessarily, but. Normally wouldn't mention LinkedIn at all, let alone in the game section, but because everything is terrible now, LinkedIn is experimenting with casual games and that because that's what
this.
You do.
Why?
You're looking for a job and then you get distracted by a game. And actually, honestly, this might be good data for a potential employer because
that's
they can
true.
See how easily, right?
Oh, look at how long the point they of it, played this stupid game.
It's like,
game
oh, look, they applied doing... for a job and then they spent 15 minutes playing this stupid tile game. No, not that guy. So that's awful. I don't know what to say. I look, even something like net. Yeah, it's awful. Like, well, what I mean is we live gamification as a thing is whatever, you know, like I'm using Duolingo to try to learn Spanish and the gamification of that app is, you know, working or whatever. It's like, I get it. Netflix adding games, I sort of get. It's vaguely another kind of entertainment, and I guess that's sort of the business they're in, sort of. I don't like that it's in the app. I feel like there should be a Netflix games app.
I agree.
And it should be separate. But of course, Netflix doesn't care what I want. They don't even let me make folders of different types of shows. So they have their own strategy. It has nothing to do with what I want. But it's sort of in the same area. This thing, what are you doing? What is
I don't get it at all whatsoever. I don't know why, other than like, this should be, I wanted to check if it was April 1st. This should have waited until April 1st.
I know it doesn't make any, right. It's like an Onion headline. LinkedIn is adding games. Like, cause you're unemployed and you have free time.
Right. It's kind of depressing, isn't it?
It's sad is what, yeah, it's not good. See, I have to use LinkedIn, cause I have like this stupid little business now and I hate it. And not the business, the LinkedIn I hate. It's stupid. It's awful. So like the notion that I would go there and be, they already send me ads as messages. What is, so what am I going to get, like a little notification? Oh, Amex has something they want to tell you. And what they want to tell me is let's play chess. No.
Oh, Paul, you haven't tried out this new game yet. Why don't you try out this new game, Paul?
Crazy. Anyway. Okay. And then finally, Sony, interestingly, was fairly successful with VR, with the PlayStation 4, with the original PSVR. Mm-hmm. Which is about $350. And then they came up with the VR 2 for the PS5, which I think started at $600, but is not today anyway, $550, which is more expensive than the console. And you will be shocked to discover they haven't sold any. Mm. And it's not doing very well. So apparently they've halted production. They previously announced that they were looking at, and I think will be bringing it to the PC, which is interesting on some level. But I think the big problem here is the cost. Like that's.
I honestly didn't know they had a second version of it.
Oh yeah.
No. How do you compete with the Quest 3 on that?
Yeah.
You're trying to go to the PC, like good luck.
Well, they have this audience, right? There's a PlayStation fan base.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've not.
They bought PS5.
So I can't speak to the quality. But.
For it to be more than the cost of the stinking console itself.
That was true with the PlayStation 4 and the original VR headset, right? The PlayStation 4 was
But it was still a couple hundred bucks less expensive.
A couple hundred bucks less. Like I think there's a threshold.
The PS5 is also more expensive.
You're right. That's it exactly, Richard. There's a threshold and it's definitely past.
It was like $250 for a PS4 and $350 for the headset.
Right.
Now it's $500 for the PS5. $550 for $200.
The co-pilot for Microsoft 365 disconnect for me, especially for consumers, where it's like, so I pay $100 a year for six people to get a terabyte of storage through Microsoft 365, all the apps, blah, blah, blah. And now you want me to pay $20 per month per user? Mm. That jump is incommensurate, to me. But not today, but in the past, using that service, actually, I'm like, okay, actually, there's some value here. But
yeah. It's funny you bring that up. I just had a lunch with a couple of business leaders and their IT person who brought me in talking about incorporating it, what they need to be concerned about lighting up M365 Copilot. Yeah. And the CFO was the one saying, I had to do this survey thing and I knew it was going to take me an hour and a half and I ran it through Copilot and it was done in 10 minutes and that paid for the month right there.
Nice. Yeah, there you go. I think I had a similar experience. I use it mostly for graphics, but in my case, it wasn't so much that it was costing me less to do the thing I was already doing. It's that I couldn't have done the thing I'm doing now.
Right.
There was no amount of money that would make it make sense for me to go to I have a friend who's a graphic artist and say, I would like four images of this ridiculous scene I just described, but don't ask. And then come back with those four and I'll say one of these is pretty good, but could you change this? And then by the time we've arrived at the image, it's 2 weeks later and I don't know what I'm doing anymore because this is just a news story.
It's that moment. So, on one hand, it's embarrassing art. On the other hand, it's instantaneous embarrassing art. So you're okay with it.
Yes. Look, why I need a picture of Ronald McDonald in space. The point is, I need this picture and I need it now.
Mostly you're paying to not be shamed.
Yeah, exactly. You're paying right behind the shame.
I would like
to. I will pay $20 a month not to be shamed.
Not to be shamed publicly. But then, of course, I put the picture on an article and I am shamed. So, but the PSVR 2, I don't feel like there's any similar advantage to it. Like, I just don't.
I'm almost feeling like we've run our course with gaming VR. Like, if it was going to take off, it would have by now. Yeah. If, Gabe Newell and the co at Steam that made Alex was a total loss leader because those guys can afford it. So they pulled together the Ringer team. They made the best VR game they could make. And it is a beautiful work of art.
By all accounts, is amazing.
A beautiful, beautiful work of art. And it still isn't enough.
Right. Right.
So if that's not going to do it, and that's 4 years old. 4 years old.
I know.
I don't know what it takes.
I want to play it so bad, but I just don't have the means to.
I know. Right. Same. Yep. Because I love Half-Life, but.
Well, it's one of the things that's interesting about it is how much time Alex spends trying to get you to look in the right direction. Like, you also see the problem with storytelling in VR, which is you're so busy looking at the world, the story can take a hike. I'm busy exploring this world.
Yep.
That's it's funny you use that example because a couple of months ago was the 25th anniversary probably for the original Half-Life. 30th, and whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And there was a documentary they made, which was fantastic. And one of the great stories that's told in that documentary is how, it's an interactive story, right? It's it's a game and there are shooter elements and all that, but really it's the unfolding of a story. And sometimes you walk into a big room and stuff's happening and they need you to see the little crack in the thing. And that part of the game design is they have to make sure you don't miss stuff. Because you could walk through a game and be like, I do in real life. And you can't be like that when you're playing this game. You're like, not just be paying attention, but see stuff.
See the right stuff. And this is a huge part of good game design.
A big part of that game design and making sure they got that stuff right. And I could imagine VR, it's worse because of course you're like,
it's way worse.
A
good game has a good cinematographer, right? Knows how to get your eye in place.
I have not listened to this, but as I promised, I wanted to generate a jingle for Xbox Corner.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
Here's what Copilot came up with. Kevin, you ready?
This song. When we're in Mexico, one of the many things that's kind of unique and different about that place is that certain things are just like two decades behind the United States. And I don't mean infrastructure. I mean like music videos. And it's like literally the 1990s there that song is every Mexican music video. That's what music is like there now. And it is like we go, certain restaurants just have like a TV on, they play music videos. And I sit there and I'm like, what is happening? Like, it's like literally like, is Debbie Gibson back? Like, or Britney Spears or whatever? Like, what is this? You know?
Oh, dear.
That's crazy.
I think
it's a lot of that stuff, you know?
Xbox.
An electro synth version of the Xbox startup noise would be fine. It's a jingle. It should be two seconds.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I said. I even said to it, make a very short jingle.
Right.
And it was still way too long.
No, this was like a girl in a tracksuit dancing and singing at the same time somehow on stage with a bunch of other people
doing weird synchronous dances. Maybe some of them are on skates. Yeah.
Exactly. Like people are moving in between and, you know. Yeah, that's every video.
Oh, man.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's weird.
Well, we will be back in just a moment after that horrible song with the tips and picks of the week just a sec. Welcome back to Windows Weekly. This week hosted by me, Micah Sargent, as well as your tried and true panelists, Paul Thurrott and Richard Campbell. It's time for the back of the book, otherwise known as the tips and picks of the week.
Man, I just realized I have PTSD from that music. It is interesting.
He's not okay.
It's not okay. Richard just brought up Alex. Alex is one of the many games that are on sale right now. And you got to be quick, unfortunately, because if you listen to the show like as late as Friday or Saturday, it's over. But through the 21st, which as we record this is tomorrow, Steam is having a big sale. And it is a big, sale. Like almost everything, not everything, but almost everything is on sale. Some really, really good prices on stuff. And I don't just mean like older stuff. Like you can buy all the old, like, you know, the Doom and Quake type games. Like that stuff is always like a couple of bucks when it's on sale, but it's, you know, newer titles. You can get the Halo Master Chief Collection, all those games, like for 10 bucks. Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order for $3.99. Sid Meier's Civilization VI, $6.99, that kind of thing. There's a lot of good stuff there.
Yeah, you may not get around to playing them all, but at least you'll own them.
But you'll save a lot of money.
That's how I am because I actually am not a gamer at all, but I get these stupid
Your Steam collection is awesome.
It is.
Movies. Like if a movie like I like hits like $4.99, I'll just buy it. And it's like, am I going to watch this again?
Still in shrink wrap.
But you know, it's there if I need it. Yeah.
We'll see. Maybe someday the world will end. I'll just have this collection. It'll be fun. So that's my tip. And then I have three app picks. I'm going to blow through these really quickly. But Stardock Object Dock 3 came out today. It's $9.99 or $3.99 to upgrade. It's now part of Object Desktop. If you have that suite, this adds a Mac OS X style dock to Windows. And you can, you know, either augment the taskbar or replace it. You can have multiple docks on every side of the screen if you're into that kind of thing. They can be folders and tabs and whatever. So it's pretty cool. It works really nicely. It's 64-bit, works on Windows 10 and 11, good stuff. Proton Mail, the native app, is available now on Mac and Windows and on Linux in beta, interestingly. They've had a web app for, I want to say, 10 or 12 years, a long, long time. But this is the privacy-focused service that has a bunch of Proton services. Proton Mail is supposed to be one of the better ones. And I am considering this right now, I got to say. They also have a password manager, or no, I'm sorry. They have a, what do you call it? An authenticator app as well. They have a bunch of stuff. They're worth looking at. And then there's a new version of Firefox out because it's been 4 weeks and there's some improvements kind of across the board, but they improved the performance of jump lists on Windows. So if you're that guy, you use Firefox and actually know what a jump list is and use one, God love you. they're both are better. On Windows, anyway.
All right. Then let's see what is next. It's time. Oh, wait. Yeah, did you mention the Firefox thing?
Did I miss one?
Yeah. I did, yeah. Okay, sorry. I was reading.
There'll be a quiz later.
Same time
Micah
as you.
Micah can tell us what he thinks a jump list is. But
I didn't
it's
realize
okay.
so many Proton products these days. So I was.
Yeah, there's a bunch.
Tell us about Run As Radio, Richard Campbell.
This week's episode is with a past guest coming back again, Steve Buchanan, known on Twitter as Bukatech. Always been a platform guy. I've talked about Kubernetes and things like that. But we ended up in this sort of meta conversation about how every sysadmin these days is a platform engineer to some degree. It's just a question of how seriously you take it. And so that ended up being the title, from sysadmin to platform engineer. Just recognizing that our job, when we do it well, is to provide platforms for places for work to be done for our organization. You know, whether you're the administrator of the M365 tenant, or if you are managing a set of servers to run applications, it's all the same issue. Is the platform able to respond to the needs of the organization, and how do we get better at that? So, you know, it's not... And products facilitate that, but it's more a mindset than it is products. And Steve really pulled all that together really well for us to really get our head around and go, you don't do Kubernetes because it's fun. You do it because it allows you to provide a platform that serves the applications your organization counts on.
Nice. Well, you can find that at runasradio.com. And the Brown Liquor Pick of the Week, interestingly, I was just chatting with the person who brought you that Bushmills recently.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
That was from last week.
Yeah, from last week. So what is the Brown Liquor Pick of the Week this week?
This week is a story. The whiskey that is listed in the sheet is not how the story is going to begin. The story is going to begin with a listener, Barry Wallace, who, while on a cruise, tweeted to me the menu of whiskeys available on his cruise and said, like, which one should I try? And I ran down a bunch of them that I recognized, but there was one on the list I hadn't seen. And this doesn't happen very often anymore. For better or worse, I'm pretty good at remembering things. And so if I had seen it before, I would have recognized it. But one of them on the list was called Macklow. and which is called an American single malt whiskey, which is interesting because the U.S. has no concept of a single malt whiskey, really. Single malt is an invention of Smith's and Sons, Glenlivet, back in the 1960s, when they wanted to show that their product was more premium. It never really meant anything, although it was later codified, initially to be the idea that it was from a malting of barley, but in reality now really means a given distillery has produced and distilled all of the products that are in the bottle. So single malts don't mean as much as it said. There's lots of pretentious folks that say, well, I'll only drink single malts, when I can make fun of them all day long. And in fact, here's one I'm going to make fun of. The lady's name is Julie Macklow. Now, Julie comes originally from Aspen, but joined J.P. Morgan as a hedge fund manager, got bitten by the whiskey bug doing her work, but ultimately married an extremely wealthy person, Billy Macklow, who is the son of one of the largest real estate tycoons in New York. So they get married back in 2004, and apparently she goes all in on being a socialite. In fact, there is an article in Vogue about her in 2009 called The Hedge Funder in Thigh-High Boots. Anyway, and she likes whiskey, which is not a sin. You can be a socialite and like whiskey. Like, all of that is fine. But apparently during the pandemic, she had been buying up rare whiskeys because it was a lot of folks were unloading their collection because they needed money during the pandemic when everything was disrupted. And so there's a whole conversation to be had about the dusty bottle movement, that as the demand for whiskey skyrocketed during the pandemic, a lot of folks that had forgotten about their collections sort of dug into them and sold really rare whiskeys. And so she decided she should make whiskey and found a guy named Ian McMillan. Now, Ian McMillan is a proper master distiller. This is a guy who's pushing 50 years working in the whiskey industry, all the way back to Glengoyne in the 1970s. He's actually well known for rehabilitating older distilleries. So he helped get Deanston back on Rhine and Tobermory, Monahabin down in Islay. And famously, he's best known at the moment for the Blaadnock distillery back in 2017, which is one of the very few lowland distilleries that exists. Like, Ian McMillan is the guy. And actually, at the moment, he's working for a group called Wolf Craig Distillers. So they're making weird new things. But in between doing Blaadnock and this, he was recruited by Julie Macklow. And they went out. She had an idea to make whiskey, but didn't actually want to make it. So instead, she found some that she could brand. Mm. And she found it from a distillery called Bull Run, which is out of Portland, Oregon. And so she bought literally a barrel, one barrel, pure barley whiskey, which is relatively unusual in the United States, which normally uses corn, but this was 100% barley, aged in American oak. It had been barreled in 2014. She then removed that barrel from the storage in Oregon and put it for a couple of years in somewhere in Kentucky. I haven't been able to find out where, but one of the rick houses there, there's plenty. And then bottled it in 2021, an entire 271 bottles, which is typical for a single barrel, somewhere in there, somewhere between 200 up to 300, depends, which she promptly priced at $1,500 US each.
Woof.
Yeah. Now, being a socialite, this is someone who eats dinner out in New York at a top tier restaurant 5-6 times a week. So she had a pretty, and was, you know, sociable with everyone around there. She's a socialite. So she pretty much sold the whiskey herself, going from fancy restaurant to fancy restaurant, getting this $1,500 edition, which they call the Black Edition, out all over the place. You can also find it, like I said, there's only a handful of bottles, although apparently they're making additional editions outside of New York, in some places in Texas, Los Angeles, Vegas, and Aspen, of course. Jean Georges apparently was an early backer on this, so definitely got this strong restaurant bar tie for it. The professional whiskey people have tasted it. They have declared it a wood bomb, which is to say it has spent too long in wood, which is normal for anything that's gone 7-8 years in this part of the world. Tannic and bitter.
Oh, Lord. So not good.
I would point out that most photos related to this particular whiskey show it in a cocktail. In fact, apparently today, If you would like to, in New York, you can go to a very swanky club called Gabriel's. Well, they will sell you a $45 cocktail called the Gold Fashion.
Oh, sorry, what?
$45. Yeah, so made the with gold the fashion. Black Edition. Yes. They recently have announced, as of last year, a new edition called the Kentucky Gold Edition. They've only been taking pre-orders, so nobody's actually tasted it, although the description of it is lovely, which, you know, they call it tasting notes, except for that part where nobody's actually tasted it. And they're going to want $260 for this. That would be, by the way, more money than the retail price on a Pappy Van Winkle 23.
No way.
Yes. Which is why I did not want to talk about this whiskey, you know, like when Barry led me to it, I hadn't seen before. Of course, I did the research and I only got angrier and angrier and angrier reading this until I went back to the root of this, which was Bull Run, right? That our friend Julie went and bought a barrel for Bull Run. And Bull Run is out of Portland, Oregon. It's been around since 2010. Lee Madoff, who worked his way through different breweries and different distilleries and so forth, set this up himself. He makes a variety of different whiskeys, but he makes a whiskey that very likely was the starting point of the Black Edition called the Bull Run Single Malt. And he's also been part of the American Single Malt Whiskey Commission, which is trying to be establishing standards for what we would call an American single malt. By the way, that bottle, $50, which is more in line with the price of a whiskey should be. You'll find it up to 100. There's a few different editions of it. He makes a bourbon as well. He does a Pinot Noir aged whiskey, which I might just want to try, as well as some vodkas and things like that. It spends 5 years in oak, which is more appropriate for that climate. It's more, and you can find it. It's buyable. It's at BevMo, you know, not a big deal. You're going to have a tough time finding any of the Macklows, and I would recommend that you don't. Right? Why don't you drink the Origin product? You'll be happier. And the current specification for what an American single malt whiskey, so the American Single Malt Whiskey Commission is in the process of ratifying this standard. So that single malt whiskey means 100% malted barley from the U.S. So U.S. barley distilled at a single distillery, same as they do in Scotland. Also aged in the U.S. and barrels no larger than 700 liters and distilled no higher than 80% and bottled no less than 40%. These very similar to what Scottish single malt would represent as. And that's a far better story than anything to talk about from a New York socialite.
Amen.
Bull Run, Oregon, single malt whiskey. Portland is fun. Go get some.
Yes, Portland's nice. Great.
Yeah.
Well,
not thank like you. New York. Jerks.
You know what? I maybe I should apologize. I went on this ride and now I've made you go on it too.
And we're all angry. That's why the lights are like red.
Of the theme of the whole show, really. We went on this ride and now you're going
on it. Now you're going on it. You know, I started talking, I was going to write about the story about the Macklow, and I was working my way through it. And I finally got to a point where I was like, I'm going to throw this away until I figured out where she got the whiskey from. And then when I read about Lee, I'm like, this guy's awesome. Yeah. This is what whiskey's about.
There we go. Well, folks, that just about brings us to the end of this episode of Windows Weekly. If you want to subscribe to the show, get the show notes, see all the fun stuff, head to twit.tv/WW. That's where you will find links to subscribe to the audio versions and video versions of the show. I should also mention that you should consider joining Club Twit at twit.tv/Club Twit. When you join the club, first and foremost, you get that warm, fuzzy feeling knowing that you are helping support what we do here at Twit. Help us keep doing what we do. $7 a month, $84 a year gets you access to Club Twit, which gets you access to ad-free versions of every single one of our shows. You also gain access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, including behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, special Club Twit events get published there. And access to the members-only Discord server, a fun place to go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. Aside from that, you also gain access to the video versions of our Club Twit exclusive shows. So there is the Untitled Linux show, there is Hands on Mac, There's hands-on Windows. There is Home Theater Geeks and iOS Today. These are all shows that are Club Twit shows. And if you want to see the video versions of those shows, that is what joining Club Twit will get you as well. I should also mention, quite literally, tickets are almost out. Head to tickets.twit.tv if you're a member of Club Twit to sign up to join us in April for a couple of recordings of This Week in Tech. And it's only, again, available to you if you are a Club Twit member. So you'll have to provide your email that's linked to your Club Twit account so we can confirm and invite you in the for one of those days. But yes, those seats are running out. So if you've been thinking about it, now's the time to hop on that. Twit.tv/Club Twit, $7 a month, $84 a year. All right, it is time to say thank you, Richard Campbell, for your work this week. Anything you'd like to plug? Any places folks should head to keep up with what you're doing?
Well, thank you, Micah, for doing the show with us. We always have a great time with you.
Thank you.
And yeah, next week I'll be at the Fabric Conference. So you'll see me coming from probably a Skyloft at the MGM Grand.
No big deal.
You know, as it turns out, if you could bring 4,000 of your closest friends to the MGM Grand, they give you a nice room.
Nice. That's exciting.
Run As Radio and .NET Rocks, still making the shows and having a good time doing them.
Beautiful. And, of course, Paul Thurrott at Thurrott.com. What's for your plug this week?
Oh, boy. I hate doing plugs. I just... You know, this is Thurrott.com. I'm on Twitter and stuff.
Every time
I'm online, I don't know. Every
time, like, I don't know. Just find me.
I do stuff. I write stuff every day.
You know, you could ask Copilot to figure out.
Copilot, what do
say.
I do?
What do what, I say during this
plug? What should I sell?
In any case, thank you for tuning in. Watch This Week at Google later today, as well as you can watch on Sunday. Leo Laporte will be back, so he and I will be doing Ask the Tech Guys on Sunday, and you can catch the rest of my shows, including Tech News Weekly, tomorrow. But until then, it is time to say goodbye, because this episode of Windows Weekly has come to a close. We're closing the window. It's down. Yeah, now's the time to play that.